Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata's sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata's sunglasses. If he's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour, the show that takes its name from Karl Marx's figure for the revolution, working away underground, changing the terrain of everyday life from below. We come to you every Monday morning at 9 here on KBOO Portland and streaming everywhere on KBOO.fm. I'm your host today, Fran Michel. Our engineer is Patricia Kullberg. Today on the Old Mole Variety Hour, Socialism and the City. Bill Resnick talks with Bhaskar Sankara, founding editor of Jacobin magazine and author of Socialist Manifesto, The Case for Radical Politics in an Age of Extreme Inequality. Sankara will be reading tomorrow evening at Powell's Books, and he talks with Bill about the renewed popularity of socialism and the possibility of what he calls class struggle social democracy. Little earlier than that tomorrow at 5 p.m., Tuesday, May 14th, climate and education activists hope that you'll show up for a rally followed by 6 p.m. board meeting of the school board to demand that Portland Public Schools follow through on its 2016 commitment to offer robust climate education. That's at BESC 501 North Dixon near the Broadway Bridge. Also on today's show, Dan Jaffe has the first part of a two-part interview with Michael Mahaffey, an urban designer and blogger at livableportland.org. They discuss how shifts in global capitalism toward increasing financialization and speculation in land and housing illuminate gentrification and the housing crisis in Portland, and they consider alternatives to the usual capital and corporate-friendly policies. And I'll have some highlights from last week's community forum on the proposed Portland budget, which would close two community centers, privatize others, and cut over 70 positions in parks and recreation while increasing funding for police. Commissioner Joanne Hardesty has proposed amendments to fully fund parks by cutting some police programs and giveaways to private developers. The City Council will be voting on the budget and those amendments at their meeting on Wednesday, May 22nd. You'll be able to find the link to today's show and its segments at our show page on the KBOO website, along with more information about segments. It usually takes a day or two after broadcast for us to post all of that. But if you subscribe to our show, the links will be delivered to you when they're ready. Visit the Old Mole Variety Hour page at kboo.fm to subscribe, as well as to find links to follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or to contact us with questions, comments, suggestions, or interest in participating. We turn now to Bill Resnick's conversation with Bhaskar Sankara about what the growth of economic inequality means for socialist politics and what lies between fully funded community centers and full socialism.
Hi, Bhaskar Sankara. Welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Bhaskar Sankara is the founder and editor of Jacobin, a relatively new radical journal. Bhaskar has recently written a book. It's hot off the presses, titled Socialist Manifesto, The Case for Radical Politics in an Era of Extreme Inequality. The book is hopeful, showing that the U.S. is ripe for democratic transformation. It draws its lessons from the history of the left that he discusses in brief but fascinating detail. And Socialist Manifesto also discusses the transformation, reconstruction, revolution. It's the process for gaining political power. What can be done today, starting today, to build the foundations and create momentum toward that necessary, radically democratic and sustainable society? And you can meet and talk to and hear Bhaskar tomorrow evening at Powell's, the Burnside store, at 7:30 p.m. That's tomorrow at Powell's. So, Bhaskar, over the last near half century, the left has tasted a good deal of disappointment and defeat. It's lost a great deal of institutional capacity. Your book acknowledges that, but Socialist Manifesto, it breathes optimism and promise about the socialist challenge. Tell us why. What's the basis of your optimism?
Well, I think for one thing, from a certain perspective, the history of the modern workers' movement, the history of the last 150 years, has also been a history of success, not just defeat. We live in a country in which, in a world in which the power of capital has in fact been chastened by class-conscious radical movements. We've seen the abolition in the advanced capitalist world of child labor. We've seen the advent of modern political democracy, which is still very inadequate, but still far better than what our rulers would have given us if we hadn't fought for it. You know, God rested on the seventh day. Many of us still get the sixth day off. So there has been a lot of achievement, and all this achievement happens when working people realize that their problems are social problems and the potential solution to these problems are collective. And I've been involved in various, you know, organizing efforts and things like that. And what I've seen is that people are fundamentally rational. They don't like being oppressed. They don't like being bullied. They don't like being exploited. And when given a better option, people will, in fact, fight back. Now, it's sometimes not rational to fight back, sometimes too risky to do a job action in which everyone could get fired. It's sometimes too risky to pursue politics as a solution to your problems instead of private individual solutions or asking family and friends for help and relying on your local community and things like that. So I think the goal of radicals, the goal of people on the left more broadly, is to just provide and help create the infrastructures of dissent that can, in fact, make collective action a more viable choice. So you're seeing it now in, let's say, things like the nationwide teacher strikes that have been happening.
Right. I think you, in the book, you talk about other reasons for hope. For example, you point out that capital is crisis-prone. That's in the short term, but in the long term, it seems to me that things can't stay as they are. The climate crisis, the housing crisis, the crisis in health care. Capital is moving in a direction where it's bringing on requirements for enormous change in the way the economy and society is shaped.
So I think one thing that's very interesting is often as socialists, we're trained to think about capitalism's contradictions, about the way in which the system is inherently unstable, about all the tensions that are baked into it. But in fact, I think what's really incredible about capitalism is its ability to absorb challenges, its mechanisms for stability. And I think what's at the center of this mechanism is the fact that workers and capital are in fact dependent on each other, but it's not an equal dependency, it's an asymmetrical dependency. Any individual worker needs their job more than any capitalist needs an individual worker. And this in itself tends to limit the extent of working class challenge to capitalist power, because within capitalist societies, you need private firms that are profitable, and that's the only way that we survive. So I see that the dilemma of social democracy, the dilemma of a lot of kind of our efforts at making reforms within the system, is that it both strengthens the position of working class people to start demanding more and more things, because you're much more apt to go on strike and start demanding things if there's full employment, basically, rather than if there's 20% unemployment. You're much more likely to go on strike if you're not dependent on your employer-provided health care and you're in a country with universal health care. Yet at the same time, the mechanism of control is still in the hands of capital, because capital can always withhold investment. They could always say, you know, listen, you're getting too raucous. We're not going to invest in new productive enterprises. We're going to maybe even flee to another country. Things change. So this is the dilemma that we try to confront, and this is why we can't just settle for reforms within the system, because ultimately capitalists have the power in their hands. They'll be able to roll back these reforms. So that's why we need to think about how do we create a layer of worker-owned institutions? How do we expand the sector that's publicly owned? How do we do things to take this power away from capital?
We have the alternatives. We know so much more. Part of the book is your history of the left. we know a lot more about doing politics and the kind of politics that could succeed. But we also have alternatives throughout both social life and economic life. Cooperatives work. We really do know a whole lot more about how to live democratically, thanks a good deal to the women's movement and, of course, the black movement in the United States and anti-racism. But we have a sense of alternatives. Maybe you could talk about those in the economy.
I mean, I think we do. I think people have a sense that things can be better in a vague sense. But I would actually counter that today, a lot of people, even though they believe that a different world is desirable, isn't necessarily, they're not positive that a different world is technically possible. Part of what we need to do is actually inculcate this idea that there is a different way and another system is possible. That's why in the book, I try to open in the first chapter by presenting a model, a vision of what a day in the life of a social citizen could look like, about what a feasible socialism could look like, because a lot of books that say they're making the case for socialism are in fact making the case against capitalism, which is still very valuable, important work, but I think we actually need to present people with a vision that makes sense. So even though there are cooperatives, there are these institutions that are existing that might signal that today, they're still operating within the framework of a competitive capitalist economy. And a lot of these institutions are easily prone to fall into the traps of NGOism or things like that, that don't really pose a real complete alternative to the governed and built around the interests of a small minority of private capitalists.
This is Bill Resnick for KABU. It's Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Bhaskar Sankara, the founder and editor of Jacobin Magazine, who's now on tour. He'll be in Portland tomorrow introducing his book, Socialist Manifesto, The Case for Radical Politics in an Era of Extreme Inequality. We've been discussing how, though the powers that be are powerful, they're also vulnerable. We have a potential for movement from below. We've had movements from below throughout our history that have, in fact, changed the way the system operates, and we have a lot of room now for doing it again. Bhaskar, you talk about that, how to make the transition or revolution, some call it, or transformation, probably a little bit of all three. Tell us, how do we move towards solving the existential problems of this society?
Well, I think we need to not counterpose ourselves to the daily struggles of people for a little bit more dignity or a little bit more bread and comfort. And I think in that sense, if you can't put something like Medicare for All, let's say, on the table, how are you going to put these broader questions of worker control of their workplaces on the table? So I think immediately our set of demands are pretty clear. I'm a supporter of Bernie Sanders. I think a lot of what his campaign represents is an immediate set of demands that will give people fighting for working class people of all races, fighting for a little bit more stability, a little bit more dignity, a little bit less kind of stress and anxiety that comes with being in medical debt, of having student debt, of having all these things that are quite common to our lives in the United States, but isn't even the case in other countries in the world that are obviously still capitalist countries with their own set of gross inequities, but at the very least more of a safety net. So I think if you fight for these reforms, they're not only good in and of themselves, and that they not only improve the lives of people, but they enable people to start asking deeper and more radical questions. There's a small portion of the left that used to think that the welfare state would buy off workers, that would make them wedded to the system and to their nation and whatever else. In fact, if you look at the history of social democracy in Europe, if you look at the history of these reform movements, in fact, reforms tend to beget more reforms and more radical reforms. And eventually you start thinking about deeper issues of industrial democracy, workplace democracies, and not just issues of bread and butter. But I think for starters, the movement around Medicare for All is really inspiring. The widespread support that's building now for something like a jobs guarantee is extremely exciting. And I think this is where leftists and progressives more generally need to orient towards these existing struggles for day-to-day fights.
Let me state a hypothesis. I think in the struggles for just the bread-and-butter reforms like Medicare for All, universal single-payer medical system, you can talk about the advantages of that system in ways that, in fact, point out to people and give them a sense of their own capacity and power and a hunger for democracy. In the energy system, it's clear that community energy, democratically run, creating cultures of use reduction, they'll work much better than what the investor-owned utilities and big finance have in store for at least their plans for implementing sun and wind energy. The medical system is, in fact, right now, to some extent, reorganizing within its limited capacity to reorganize towards far more power and decision in people who are not doctors. Nurses, for example, are just fighting for power, and they're gaining it because they're the ones who run the wards and are in power and are often making decisions and, in fact, challenging sort of physician authority. It seems to me we can talk about those things. In talking about Medicare for All, we can talk about why a public system would be far better for patients, and it would be the medical care that our people deserve, just like the teachers are pushing for. So we can talk about a really democratic future even within efforts just to save public education or to get a socialized medical system.
Right. And Bill, it's also the question of how are you fighting for these reforms?
Right.
So you could fight for Medicare for All in a way that really pushes a confrontation against big corporations and against healthcare companies and CEOs, and it's built as a kind of a class conflict of working people demanding something. Or you could fight for healthcare reform in the way that Obama did it, which is by trying to get everyone at the table and trying to create a system that panders and subsidizes to the private industry as it is. So it's not just kind of what you're fighting for, it's how you're fighting for it. I think socialists in particular have a vision of the world that says that if you want to organize to make reforms, you have to organize working people, you have to support unions, you have to support all these other efforts, and you have to actually confront people who have power. We can't just all have nice things. It's going to involve taking some of the power and privilege and wealth from a certain group of people and distributing it to the vast majority of people.
In the Socialist Manifesto, you talk about the labor movement and class struggles. Tell us why you see the labor movement and uniting people as a social class as a fundamental necessity.
Well, socialists have always historically been interested in workers, not because they're weak and oppressed and exploited, but because they're in fact potentially very strong. They're at a very strategic position in the economy by virtue of being in these sites of production, be it places where goods are created, places where services are created. Workers have the power to withhold their labor and actually create disruptions far beyond their numbers. So whereas a consumer boycott of 10 million people might have some effect on the economy, a strike of 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 workers strategically positioned in the economy can in fact have just as much of a disruptive effect. So historically, socialists have looked to workers in certain manufacturing sectors. They looked to longshoremen. They looked to these workers that were at these central nodes in the economy and said, all right, these people have certain special social and strategic weight. I think today some of these sectors are different. They're changing. Nurses and teachers, I think, are at a very important sector in the economy, and I think that's where a lot of our organizing efforts should be going. There's also all these workers working in the logistics field. You know, we're seeing the cropping up of these Amazon warehouses all over the country, and even though a lot of people are afraid of automation and all these other things in these factories, the truth is that if you have an organized base of a few dozen workers at an Amazon warehouse, you could potentially create a large disruption in the economy and from that basis push forward a lot of demands. The other thing is, it's really still a mass base. Our union density is low. It's only 10% of the total workforce, 10-11%. A lot of that's in the public sector. But that's still millions of people that are banded together in a political organization, political organizations that are fighting not just for wages, but in the best cases, you know, not all the unions are built the same, but in the best cases are also bringing in political demands too. So it's still an important seat of power. But I think we should not just accept unions as they are. We need to also figure out a way to make them more democratic, less bureaucratic, and actually seats of power and politicization. Unions are often the place where a nurse, for example, who had never been involved in politics before, might see herself as a political actor that has power and could actually influence things that are going on in her community. And that's often the training ground for working class people to the extent they're getting politicized. And obviously, on the other front, there's elections, there's a whole host of social movements and other things, but nothing compares with the strategic power that workers potentially have in their place of work.
You know, that argument goes for our own movements. Often we become top-down and centralized. And what we lose, of course, is the discussion. Democratic unions are extremely important. Putting the stewards and individual workers into positions of power and decision and thoughtfulness and solidarity. But that's also true of our movements. They have to, in fact, educate and provide people with the opportunities for the kind of self-development that makes them into subjects of history, making history rather than being the obedient subjects of other forces. Tell us about the kind of left movements that we need.
Well, yeah, I think we need ultimately to create something where we have institutions that are raising the level of class consciousness and organization across working class communities. It used to be a little bit easier in other contexts for people on the left. You know, you could be on the far left, and let's say you're in Italy in the 1970s, you're going through a working class district in Italy, you would see a bunch of people who were largely in the main, let's say 60%+ of them, were voting for a party that kind of democratic socialist or social democratic party, nominally committed to the cause of socialism, but doing it in a very slow way, or maybe not even really planning to get there, but committed to this horizon of change and that had the sense of self, the sense of being a member of a class that has certain shared political objectives. In the U.S., we often are our starting point where we are not just convincing people that they should pursue a more radical vision of change, but in fact that change is possible and that politics can actually make a difference. So what I envision today is kind of the rebuilding of community organizations that could take a variety of forms. It could be a tenant union. It could be engaging in, you know, sort of even politicized social service work and things like that that are imbued with a sense of class consciousness and raising the expectations and power of people. But right now, to be perfectly honest, the real breakthrough we're seeing is in the electoral realm. So even though I don't think that elections is where we should put all of our energy, it's very clear that something like the Sanders campaign is galvanizing millions to start thinking about themselves and thinking about what they deserve and not just individualizing all these supposed failings. You're unemployed, people are tempted to think that they just need to reformat their CV or that they need to take a coding class or whatever else. But when something like the Sanders campaign comes around, they can maybe see these things not as individual failings, but as social problems that need collective solutions. So I think this is almost like a jump start. And all these socialists now joining DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America, there's around 60,000 of them, they can actually, in fact, participate in this process if they're rooted in working class communities of helping to support labor movement struggles, about connecting with things like tenant struggles, about, you know, supporting these local insurgent electoral campaigns. Like I'm calling you now, I'm speaking from Chicago, and Chicago, of course, just elected a half dozen Democratic Socialists to its city council of just 50 people. So you get something like 12% of the Chicago City Council being socialists, many of whom are DSA members. So I think this is super exciting, but obviously just a start. So we're rebuilding a lot of what was lost in the last 3-4 decades of defeat in the United States. It's going to take a long way to get there. I think eventually, to be perfectly honest, we're going to need a independent party that's rooted in the interests of working people, which I think are distinct from the interests of capitalists, about people who own things and have wealth in this country are fighting for different things in different ways than people like me or you that don't have wealth and power. And ultimately, I think we need to have that kind of party, but we have to move in that direction realistically, knowing the limitations on third parties, knowing how difficult it is to make that kind of leap in the United States, and knowing the reasons why we failed in all these attempts to do something like this over the last 120 years.
Let's conclude on a burst of optimism. This last election was a great insurgency against both political, major political parties. The old hands in the parties have been repudiated by the majority of the people. it seems to me we're at a point where people are really looking for alternatives. They know that something is rotten, and a lot of things are rotten, and that things have to change. We're at a point where I think we can convert those suspicions and the anxiety and the insecurity of most people in this country into political action, because the Sanders campaign demonstrated that. Bhaskar, you got the last word.
I think one thing that's really happening right now is that people are fed up and they're looking for alternatives and they're angry. And in 2016, there were only two candidates really speaking to their anger. There was the right populist approach of Trump that told a lot of working people that, in fact, the reason why they weren't getting enough is because women, because people of color, because immigrants, all these other people were getting their slice of the pie. And then on the other hand, there was Sanders saying that, you know, listen, the reason why you're working hard, you're not getting enough, isn't because of immigrants, it's not because of minorities, it's because millionaires and billionaires are getting more and more of the wealth that we are all collectively creating. And the way to get back at them is to band together and have this kind of political revolution to take away some of their power and wealth. And it's insufficient. I think it needs to go even deeper and even further than that, but it's a start.
It sure has to institutionalize in lots of ways where power can be exerted. And
it needs to exist beyond election campaign, exactly.
And defended. Bhaskar Sankara, tomorrow at Powell's, people can meet Bhaskar, talk to him. That's at 7:30 at Powell's, the downtown store. Thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Bill, and I hope everyone comes out. It's my first trip to Portland, so I'm looking forward to it.
Bhaskar, good talking to you. Thanks.
Thanks again. Take care. I'll see you soon.
Right. So long.
All right. Bye. Come all ya good workers, good news to you, I'll tell about the good old union as to win it.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Fran Michelle, your host today. And that was Bill Resnick talking with Bhaskar Sankara about his Socialist Manifesto, The Case for Radical Politics in an Age of Extreme Inequality. As I said, he'll be appearing tomorrow, Tuesday, May 14th at 7:30 p.m. at Powell City of Books on Northwest 10th and Burnside. That's just right after the school board meeting at 6 in North Portland. The growth of the Democratic Socialists of America seems to be having an impact on Portland. At last week's community forum on Mayor Wheeler's proposed budget for the city, DSA members and organizers were among those who gave excellent testimony, along with folks from Care Not Cops, Laborers Local 483, Right to Survive, and other groups, as well as other Portlanders who live, work, parent, study, and recreate around the city. As I mentioned earlier, the mayor's proposed budget would close two community centers and cut jobs in the Parks and Recreation Department while increasing the budget for police. Commissioner Joanne Hardesty proposed an amendment to fully fund Parks and Rec, as well as elections and the census, by cutting some of the proposals that would benefit police and developers. So here's a sampling of comments from Kelsey Owens, Emily Golden Fields, Alyssa Pagan, Sandra Comstock, Jamie Dosher, Sarah Iannarone, and Demetra Giannikoulias.
Taking away a community center and then talking about wanting to continue funding something that just basically incarcerates people and disproportionately attacks Black communities makes no sense. We cannot afford the private centers. Not everybody over there is rich. I'm on OHP. I don't have $1,100 to afford preschool in the fall when you close my $200 option.
It is the heart of our neighborhood. It is the only affordable care option. We have a waiting list of up to 100 people trying to get into aftercare. It will create a childcare desert in this city. That is what this will do. And privatizing and closing them down is just the wrong course. It's not the moral decision, it's not the correct decision, and it's not necessary. Mary King, an economist, just wrote a way that we can expand the Portland Clean Energy Fund to actually fund mental health services, to fully fund parks, to expand our preschools. This is the heart of communities. We should be expanding them. We should be funding them. They are what make working families be able to live in this city.
When you have a thriving community, yes, then you have a community that doesn't need to be constantly policed.
Yes.
Okay? Okay, so that's why we say care, not cops. Has anyone here ever seen a sweep of a homeless encampment? It is one of the most disgusting things that I have ever seen in my life, is watching someone who is barely surviving and only wants to sleep under a little bit of shelter. And you send in the police and you arrest them and you take away everything they have and you throw it in the garbage. And 52% of the arrests that your police made last year were of those people. So I am letting you know that I am not the only one who sees the inhumanity in a decision like that. The money that you want to take that track record and you want to expand it. You want to give them more money. Thank you for having 52% of your arrests be people who are barely surviving, that could die any day. Some Portlanders die at the hands of the police, and you want to give them more money. We're watching.
By community centers, having welcoming and attended hygiene access increases community connection, mutual support, and mental health. Building understanding and opportunities for housed and unhoused collaboration reduces strife, fear, and the impulse to call 911 every 15 minutes on unwanted people. If we do these things, we don't need the same amount of policing anymore.
If we talk about the cost in staffing for an entire year at one pool, it will cost $900 in staffing. So you're saving $900 at the expense of $8,250 in revenue. That math doesn't make sense. If they stay open, the projection is that there's going to be $200,000 in net revenue for all preschool. If you close them, which is what the plan is, it will drop down to $25,000. In net revenue. So closing two sites, you are losing $175,000 net revenue.
I want to question the $1.5 million out of the transportation budget for derelict RV enforcement. I am against displacement without replacement for any person experiencing houselessness. And to spend $1.5 million in transportation money to essentially sweep people who have essentially a home is not a good use of our transportation dollars. And finally, I would like to question the false choices that we're being presented with here tonight. Oregon has the third fastest number of millionaires after North and South Dakota. You have to assume a good number of those are in Portland. If we only had millionaires in Portland, if there were only 50 people as rich as you, Mayor Wheeler, and they taxed themselves 10%, we could cover the entire park shortfall annually. That's 50 millionaires. The number of millionaires that we probably have is far, far higher.
In the last several weeks, our community has learned of the expert financial analysis commissioned by Parks and Recreation's Union. The result of this analysis has revealed that general fund revenues over expenses have yielded an average $54 million surplus over the last 5 years. And also that unrestricted net assets in the Internal Services Fund average almost $90 million, also in the last 5 years. Meanwhile, we learned that general fund expenditures have been declining by as much as 6% per year. So we're confused. In light of these figures, we do not understand why the Bureau wishes to cut programs and especially to cut full-time, frontline, expert-dedicated staff who are the heart and soul and the lifeblood of our community centers. We have called, we have emailed, we have sent letters, we have offered many solutions, but we feel we've been kept in the dark. What happens when we don't see this transparency is that we are left to speculate and hypothesize ulterior motives, which does not build goodwill. Our quality of life, the health of our communities are about to be irrevocably diminished, and we feel betrayed by that.
Well, let's tax the rich, please. Don't cut the parks.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland, and that was a sampling of voices from the most recent community forum on the city budget. You heard, in order, Kelsey Owens, Emily Goldenfields, Alyssa Pagan, Sandra Comstock, Jamie Dosher, Sarah Iannarone, and Dimitra Giankoulias. When we post that segment on the KBOO.fm website, we'll include more information about the budget and about the city council meeting, about it happening on Wednesday afternoon, May 22nd. In other local action, recall that back in 2016, the Portland Public Schools Board of Education unanimously passed Resolution 5272, which directs PPS to develop an implementation plan for curriculum and education opportunities that address climate change and climate justice in all Portland public schools. The superintendent has ignored this resolution, but students, teachers, parents, and other concerned Portlanders are going to the board at 5 p.m. tomorrow to demand that PPS honor its commitments. That's at BESC 501 North Dixon, near the Broadway Bridge. Next, on the Old Mole Variety Hour, Dan Jaffe talks with scholar and urban designer Michael Mahaffey about global finance and Portland's housing crisis.
A growing crisis of housing and rental affordability, gentrification, displacement, and houselessness is everywhere in the news in Portland and around the country and worldwide. Here in Portland and at the Oregon State Legislature, major policy changes, including Portland's residential infill plan and Oregon House Bill 2001, which would mandate that cities allow multi-unit housing on any residential lot, are moving forward and generating a great deal of controversy and polarization. But what are the national and global dynamics behind these interconnected crises? How does understanding shifts in global capitalism, including shifts toward increasing financialization and speculation in land and housing, help us to shed light on what's going on here in the Portland area and Oregon? What does the experience of other cities have to offer us locally in terms of lessons about what works and what doesn't, and what alternatives are there which would better address the very real problems in housing equity and affordability that we're facing? Joining us to discuss these issues and more is Michael Mahaffey. He is an urban researcher at KTH University in Stockholm, Sweden. He is also the executive director of the Portland-based Systasis Foundation. He is an urban designer and strategic development consultant, and he's been active in Portland area planning and building since 1991. He also hosts the blog livableportland.org. This is the first part of our two-part interview, and you can catch the second half of our discussion next Monday on the Old Mole Variety Hour. So welcome, Michael Mahaffey.
Thank you, Dan. I'm delighted to be here, and I'm really interested in the topics that you're talking about as well, because I think one of the things we really need to do here in Portland to get a handle on our challenges is to learn from other cities and have this experience of exchanging knowledge about what's happening globally, the global forces that are coming home to roost right here in Portland.
So let's start out by discussing the roots of these linked crises of housing affordability, gentrification, displacement, and homelessness that are really hitting us here in Portland, many other U.S. cities, as well as worldwide. What do you see as the primary causes of these crises?
Well, I think there are really two major factors. One is, you alluded to earlier, the financialization of real estate, the financialization of housing, of our homes and of our cities. And that is going on, you know, at a blistering pace around the world. You and I were talking earlier about the work of Saskia Sassen, who has documented some of the really amazing and breathtaking trends that are happening, empty condo units and consortia that are buying up properties and raising prices, kicking people out, and so on. And the other factor, though, is I think really our fault. It's our failure to understand the nature of these challenges, and we end up making solutions that are simplistic, and they're sort of silver bullet solutions where we're trying to come up with a magic formula. High on that list, I would put the so-called build baby build approach. It's true that we need supply to meet demand, but the idea that just adding supply in some sort of abstract sense is going to magically cure all of our problems is really naive on our part, I think, and we have to really re-examine some of our assumptions when it comes to that sort of thinking. It really matters what we build, and it matters where we build, and that's really something that I don't think we've come to terms with yet.
Let's talk a little more about financialization and speculation. You're talking about the sociologist Saskia Sassen, and she's written about these explosive increases in speculation in land and real estate, especially since the global financial crisis.
Right.
My understanding reading her work is that sort of capital looking for profitable asset classes has sort of moved into not just, you know, commodities, but in now into urban land. You know, she talked about $1 trillion in buying of buildings in just the 2014-2015 year, many of which buildings, you know, left empty, particularly in, you know, big global cities like New York and Paris and London. But talk a little more about these dynamics. Global investors, international investors, pools of mobile capital looking at land as a profitable investment. And to what extent are we seeing that those same dynamics here in Portland? Is that money reaching us here?
Yes, it is. And, unfortunately, we tend to think of this as a Manhattan problem or a London or Paris problem. But the fact of the matter is there's a tsunami that's waving over us, washing over us, and is going to knock us flat if we don't get a handle on it. As you were saying, Saskia Sassen and others have documented this incredible surge that's going on right now in investment. And, you can understand it from the point of view of the people who are making the investments. They're often, you know, they have currency in countries like China and Russia and so on, and they want to get their money into what they consider stable assets. So American real estate is looking really, really good to them as a place to park their capital. And so what they're doing is essentially treating housing units, homes, as investment vehicles, as kind of safe deposit boxes where they can park this capital. And in the process, what they're doing, as you say, is they're not really terribly concerned about the return. They may leave the units empty, or they may jack up the rents astronomically. And then when the people move out, they don't lower the rents because they don't really care, because it's not really the point to earn a return on that investment. It's the point is to park that capital. So this is an incredibly powerful force that is going on around the world today, and Portland is unfortunately in that front line. We're maybe not the first tier of big cities that are feeling that pressure, but we're certainly part of that now.
Who are the other major sort of categories of players or interest groups? Other kinds of investors, but also, so who's in the mix? Developers, and what types of developers are we looking at? Builders, realtors, before we sort of talk about what these people want out of City Hall or what they want out of state government, who else is important to sort of understand as being part of the cast of characters here?
Right. Well, let me first sort of make a confession here, which is that I am part of the community of consultants and urban designers and developers. I've been part of development companies, had my own development company. That said, I'm sort of a dissident member of that group. In fact, I sometimes jokingly refer to that group as the architectural industrial complex. And so when I say that, I include myself in that, and I critique myself as well as my colleagues who are part of this community. But the problem is that we lose touch with some of the larger values that are really important in a democracy. And so we need to temper those judgments that we make. And the related problem is that we become vulnerable to these forces of global capital and investment money. We get, in a way, corrupted by the rationalization of our own self-interest. And the great Jane Jacobs, the great urbanist who was in New York City, but actually came to Portland and advised people here at the same time. She was a big crusader against the moneyed interests and the people who were wanting to build freeways and demolish huge tracts of neighborhoods and displace people and build projects that were ultimately unsuccessful. All those kinds of things. I think what we're seeing now is a kind of resurgence of that same kind of mentality that Jacobs was fighting. The sort of Robert Moses mentality, if you will. But now it's on steroids because it's fueled by this incredible surge of capital and real estate investment in particular. So I worry really about where we are right now as a city, as a city government and as a city culture, that the thinking at this point is quite distorted, unable to recognize what Jane Jacobs called the kind of problem a city is, and the kind of problem gentrification is, and the kind of problem affordability and sustainability are, and so on and so forth.
Let's get into some of the leading towards some of the specifics. Next week, we'll get into the real nuts and bolts of some of the actual proposals that are on the table right now, Portland's residential infill project and some of the state legislation. But sort of to get there, you talk about the increasing prevalence of what you call a build, baby, build mentality. We've got a mayor who has declared, Mayor Wheeler has declared that his goal is to sort of get as much new development approved as possible to shorten approval times. In Portland's unusual commission system of government, he recently assigned to himself all of the planning and housing related bureaus, and his sort of stated goal is to sort of speed things up. What specifically do you see happening at the city level that raises concern for you? What are the dynamics you're looking at?
Well, you raise an important point, which is that the structure of the bureau system and the structure of our commission is deeply problematic when it comes to, you know, democratic representation of people on the east side of the river, for example, and especially in the far eastern neighborhoods and the other neighborhoods that aren't part of the core. And so I think that is a huge complication of the problems that we have today. And I think, as I said before, there's a distorted judgment that's going on. And of course, the problem right now is that the city is facing a crisis. People are increasingly alarmed by what's happening. And there's a temptation, I think, to reach for the silver bullet, to find something that we can cling to and hope that it will solve the problem. And at this very moment, of course, the thing that some people are promoting is something that is incredibly profitable to their own interests, which is, oh, hey, you really need to deregulate. You really need to, raise building heights and lower zoning restrictions and do all the other things so that we can build, baby, build. And on the theory, the very simplistic theory, as I said before, that just adding supply is going to better meet demand and prices will lower. And, of course, the problem with real estate, like a lot of urban systems, is that it's not that linear. It's a complex system, and you get all these unintended consequences. So, you know, you can actually add supply that makes a place more attractive and more people move there with more money and actually raise the value of the surrounding properties. But I think the lesson of that is that we have to be careful. We have to understand that this is a dynamic system. If you look at the evidence and the research, if you look at places like Vancouver, BC, for example, you see that build, baby, build does not work in the vast majority of cases. You really need a suite of tools, not only adding supply, but dealing with tax policy and regulation of foreign investments and all these other things that, as you said, we can talk about in a little more detail later.
Let's get a little bit more into those claims, though. What we read a lot, and I think what we hear a lot, is a connected set of claims. One, that there was and talking particularly about housing redevelopment in already residential urban areas, because I think in the Portland area, certainly a lot of the sort of the conflict has happened around the inner neighborhoods, the desirable inner neighborhoods, where developers are now finding it profitable to, say, demolish small existing homes and replace them with either a single mega mansion or maybe on a corner lot, two houses, very large, far more expensive. What we think we often hear, the reason that we're sort of facing an availability and an affordability crisis, is A, that there was underbuilding during the recession, B, that housing regulations are far too strict and prohibit developers from finding it attractive to create new units, that only by creating a lot more new units will we sort of solve the affordability problem. And drilling down there a little bit, I think the market is interested primarily in development that's affordable, that's profitable, building for upper middle income people and wealthy people, the high end of the housing market. When discussing this, a lot of sort of city officials and promoters of these policies respond that only by increasing supply, even if it's at the middle and upper middle end of the high end of the market, will the extra supply sort of trickle down and increase availability and increase affordability eventually at the lower end of the market. What's your response to those claims?
Well, as I said before, it is true that we need supply to meet demand, but the question is what supply and where is the supply? And, you know, part of the problem is this idea that you take existing small homes that often are, you know, African-Americans live there or other people. I know a lot of African-Americans are very concerned about what's happening right now. And the relatively affordable houses are being demolished, and then a bigger home or a duplex is being put in its place. And yeah, maybe theoretically you're getting two units instead of one, but if you demolished a $300,000 home and you've got two $650,000 or $700,000 homes, you're not moving in the right direction when it comes to affordability, or for that matter, equity or sustainability. I mean, the problem is that it's a single variable thinking. It's you know, magic bullet thinking that just add units and that will solve our problems. I'm not saying you don't need to add units, but I'm saying we've got to be thinking more in terms of systems and broader urban systems. For example, there's this idea that if we only concentrate in the core, that's the place where everybody the lifestyles will be the most sustainable and everybody will have transportation and maximum opportunity and so on and so forth. The problem with that thinking is that it ignores the reality of the situation, which is that most people in the Portland region live in the suburbs, and many of them have been displaced to the suburbs because they've been forced to move out of the core. Because we've been over-concentrating on the core. We've had these policies of, you know, build, baby, build, which has resulted in, you know, very nice, very attractive condo units and towers and so on and so forth. And again, that tends to create a more desirable city, and that attracts more people who are, in many cases, coming out of much higher property markets like San Francisco, Los Angeles, Seattle, and Vancouver. And when they're lured to Portland, I think it has less to do with the recession than the fact that we're bringing these people in who have a lot more money at the same time that we're bringing investors in, and going back to the global picture. So the actual mix of what's happening here is not going to move us in the direction of more affordability or more equity or more sustainability, unless we think of the region as a system, and we understand that we have to also work on the suburban areas. There's this theory, I call it voodoo urbanism, and I'll explain what I mean by that. Some of the listeners, maybe the people my age perhaps, will remember that George Bush Sr. famously criticized Ronald Reagan for his voodoo economics. And what he was talking about was supply-side economics, the trickle-down economics, you know, create policies that favor the wealthy and favor the investment in big companies, and it'll trickle down to everybody else, to the small companies and so on and so forth. And there's been a lot of criticism of that economic theory, starting with George Bush Sr., ironically enough. And I think what we're dealing with here in Portland is what I call voodoo urbanism. It's a version of the same thing, and essentially it's the idea that if we just build a lot of tall condo units and we make the core really a great place, and yeah, we'll have so much money that we'll be able to create some affordable housing and set-asides and so on, that engine of growth will solve all of our problems. I really see that thinking in the city government right now, this idea that let's focus on the core, let's really concentrate and overheat the core, and, you know, get the creative class going, the sort of Richard Florida theory of urbanism. Ironically enough, Richard Florida has backed off of that theory and has recognized that this problem is backfiring. This theory is backfiring and creating gentrification and displacement and increasing inequality, increasing homelessness and many other problems. So I think we've got to think differently about the nature of our urban challenges. We've got to think more systemically. And my good colleague Joe Courtwright has written a paper where he essentially says, build baby, he doesn't call it that. That's my my term, but build baby, build will work. Because if you have people, it's a little like musical chairs, you know, if you have the people moving into the big tall condos, they'll move out of the other buildings, and other people will move out of the other buildings and so on, and that'll free up more units. But that fails to recognize that, wait, Joe, you've got more people moving into the region. You've got people with much more money moving in from these other markets. You've got
well, and you've got the foreign investors and the national investors.
All these things. So he's not seeing, for whatever reason, he's not seeing the big picture. That's my view.
I find it, and we'll begin to wrap up here for the first segment for this week. I'm sort of struck by an irony that progressive or ostensibly progressive politicians and activists, many of whom are very sort of critical of the effects of deregulated markets, many of whom would probably agree that our current crisis of housing affordability and homelessness was seriously exacerbated by the kinds of deregulation that we've had since the 1980s and exacerbated by the recession, the foreclosure crisis, and our soaring inequality, who see the failures of deregulated markets, somehow are still or simultaneously wanting to believe or claiming that more deregulation of the housing market will solve our current affordability problem. What do you think explains this disconnect?
Yeah, it's ironic, isn't it? I mean, that Portland, which is conceives of itself as a progressive city, and yet this voodoo urbanism, which is, as I'm arguing, is a kind of a species of supply-side economics, has taken the city by storm. And, you know, people who have somehow come to embrace the idea that this is going to promote equity, it's going to be, you know, Portland for all, everybody's going to have a place to live, and it's going to promote lower housing prices, and it's going to promote sustainability and so on. I don't see any of that evidence. I see quite the contrary, and the literature that I'm familiar with is alarming, frankly.
I've been talking with Michael Mahaffey, and we've been discussing the global and national forces at work creating sort of our interlinked crises of housing affordability, gentrification, displacement, and homelessness. And we're going to continue the conversation next week on the Old Mole Variety Hour. We're going to get into more nuts and bolts and specifics about some of the actual proposals at the city level here in Portland and at the state level. Michael Mahaffey, thank you so much for joining us this week.
Thank you, Dan.
We got all this technology. Our dream was bold and vague. And then one city got bad planners. One city got the plague.
This is KBOO Portland. I'm Fran Michelle, and you've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. And as we know, it's not really just one city. Also, no shade to practitioners of Voodoon. Thanks to everyone who made today's show happen. Thanks to Patricia Kullberg for engineering. Thanks to Bill Resnick and Bhaskar Sankara for their conversation on socialism. Thanks to Clayton Morgeridge for editing. Thanks to Kelsey Owens, Emily Golden Fields, Alyssa Pagan, Sandra Comstock, Jamie Dosher, Sarah Ayanaron, and Dimitra Gianculius, and everyone else who spoke at the City Budget Forum. Thanks to Dan Jaffe and Michael Mahaffey, who will be back next week with the second part of their important conversation on housing and finance. In a day or two, you'll be able to find this episode of The Old Mole through our page at kboo.fm, along with relevant links. While you're at our page, you can also find links to like and follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and to subscribe to the show and share it with your friends. The Old Mole Variety Hour will be back next Monday at 9 a.m.